Thank you very much for having me. I want to thank especially the Sydney Southeast Asian Studies Center, as well as the China Studies Center here, for having me. And I'm looking forward to the panelists and discussions to come today. I know you have a great lineup of speakers, in fact. So what I thought I'd do is focus on some larger conceptual issues, specifically regarding questions about regions and patterns of regional integration, and especially China's implications for ASEAN and Southeast Asia. In 2013, China announced a number of bold economic institutional initiatives. I think, as some of us are aware, these included most notably the New Silk Road Economic Belt and the 21st Century Maritime Silk Road. Collectively known as One Belt, One Road, or simply Belt and Road, they would also be additionally supported by a China-initiated bank that was also proposed in 2013, namely the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Each of these initiatives is made remarkable, at very least for its scope, for their scope. If successful, Belt and Road promises to connect via trade and investment networks and infrastructure connections more than 60 emerging foreign markets and a population of over 4 billion people. Similarly, in the case of the AIIB, it is remarkable that this new upstart bank, which officially went into operation this year, is able to boast now a founding membership of 57 members, with more states knocking on its door, and a capital account of $100 billion, or twice the original amount originally projected. Each of these initiatives is also made especially remarkable for China's proactive initiative. In fact, it's fair to say that these three initiatives, Belt and Road and also the AIIB, rank as three of China's most ambitious initiatives to date. Belt and Road has many dimensions, but I'd like to focus on two in particular. So, one, some of the different ways that Belt and Road interacts and intersects and engages Southeast Asia, and two, the implications for patterns of regional integration and how a region is organized, or put another way, the economic and institutional dimensions of regional order. The question is, what do these initiatives signify for the shape, content, and structure of regional order in Southeast Asia and also East Asia more broadly? When we think about regional order, we often focus on the more conventional geostrategic developments and maneuverings of states. Yet as important as those are, there's also an argument to be made that a fuller picture of regional order, as well as the overall trajectory of China's complex relations with Southeast Asia, that a fuller picture requires that we also consider the ways that its geostrategic engagements are also supplemented and conditioned by other engagements in both economic and institutional realms. Indeed, one might go so far as to argue that it's the interactions of these different dimensions that produce the peculiar features of East and Southeast Asia's regional order. In the case of Belt and Road and the AIIB, there's been a lot of vigorous discussion, for example, in Washington, Europe, Canberra, and other OECD countries about the implications of China's initiatives for the Western liberal order and its institutions. Yet as important as these debates may be, China's initiatives may have the greatest significance for those at the regional level. Not only will China's initiatives be most acutely felt regionally and locally, but the size of China's economic presence relative to regional states also suggests high potential to reorder its periphery regions in ways that can challenge more established regional actors and regional arrangements. For Southeast Asian states, which offer key regional connecting points along the Belt and Road, the regional order implications of Chinese initiatives may be especially huge and also especially complicated. Not only does Southeast Asia sit at the intersection of US arrangements and emerging Chinese ones, but also Belt and Road also has implications for the Association of Southeast Asian Nations and ASEAN Southeast Asia's own integration agendas. It's also worth noting that this period of Chinese proactive economic initiative coincides with its equally proactive moves in places like the South China Sea. These create problems and dilemmas, obviously. Concerns, for example, about geopolitical leverage, but also domestic challenges in those states that feel competing nationalist and economic pressures. Southeast Asia's predicament is made additionally complicated by the fact that compared to other regions along China's periphery, Southeast Asia has also been characterized by a much more developed set of overlapping and networked institutions and cooperative frameworks, associated in particular with ASEAN. For us to draw attention to ASEAN and its ASEAN-linked arrangements is also to remind us that China's economic and institutional initiatives of late do not take place in a political or institutional vacuum. Rather, China's initiatives enter into a political and institutional context distinguished by frameworks reflective of ASEAN's projected integrative logics, imperatives, and practices. Logics, imperatives, and practices that define and structure both why and how we come together. For ASEAN states, this system of overlapping arrangements has offered more than platforms from which these states can engage, dialogue, and pursue new cooperation. But also these integrative logics and imperatives and practices have also served to justify what many call ASEAN's institutional centrality, in which ASEAN states have enjoyed notable convening and agenda-setting powers and privileges. These arrangements are far from unchallenged and far from uncontested, but I think we can agree that they have provided both states and ASEAN as an institution the opportunity for important diplomatic recognition and geostrategic space to maneuver for now two decades. The system of networked ASEAN institutions also means that compared to Central Asia, South Asia, or other regions along the Belt and Road, ASEAN states also have more at stake. To be more specific, for Southeast Asian states, what's at stake is not just the conventional economic and strategic interests that so much of us focus on, but also projections of regional order in which smaller states enjoy at minimum equal standing. Other China's initiatives are far from being ASEAN's only challenge. Indeed, the idea of small to middle powers occupying such a place of institutional centrality has been both a practically and normatively challenged one since the start. Certainly, the recent heightening again of maritime tensions, the geopolitical jockeying between the big powers of the world and of the region, additionally adds to that challenge. Nevertheless, China's Belt and Road stands out. It stands out for its many varied dimensions. It also stands out for its projected developmental priorities and also its projected conceptualizations of security. It is such priorities and conceptualizations at once familiar but also divergent from those of ASEAN states that also adds to its significance. On the one hand, its familiarity is what makes it a powerfully attractive force. On the other, its critical differences in its integrative logics and rationales, that is why we come together, also have critical bearing on some very practical and political questions confronting the region and ASEAN's place in it. In particular, it has bearing on how a region should be organized, who gets to participate, what and who is protected, what its institutions look like, and which actors get to play the region's leading roles. Put another way, more than some other kinds of challenges, Belt and Road has the potential to redirect, reorganize, and reconceptualize existing arrangements via conceptions of region and regionalism that contrast from those that ASEAN and ASEAN centrality have been based. So let me turn to the question of Belt and Road in Southeast Asia. China's Belt and Road initiatives, along with the AIIB, are especially distinguished by their emphasis on infrastructure, development through infrastructure, and also regional connectivity. Belt and Road is about building highways, railways, waterways, ports and hubs, energy pipelines, joint development projects, e-commerce, economic zones, and the list goes on. But underlying Belt and Road is an important political ethos and logic, namely that development may be best pursued through such infrastructure projects and regional connectivity. The AIIB is an investment, is an infrastructure bank. And while there are other banks, for example, the ADB, the Asian Development Bank, that also support infrastructure, the AIIB nevertheless stands out for making infrastructure development its exclusive mandate and reason for being. In both China's Belt and Road initiatives and its overall periphery diplomacy, Southeast Asia has occupied a prominent place. Partly this has to do with geography. Geographic proximity heightens, for example, the potential for strategic and developmental interdependence between China and Southeast Asian states. And we can think about strategic and developmental interdependence in both a local and individual state sense, as well as a regional sense. Meanwhile, strategically and economically, Southeast Asia serves as the connective link between land and sea, and also between the Pacific and Indian Oceans. Continental Southeast Asia is made additionally important by the fact that its states are most comprehensively interdependent with China's domestic subregions and provinces. Maritime Southeast Asia, as again the connecting link between Pacific and Indian Oceans, may also be especially important then to China's maritime Silk Road. Within East Asia, Southeast Asia has less developed and less resourced states compared to their Northeast Asian neighbors, for example, are also states with needs that might be especially receptive to China's developmental initiatives. In this sense, Southeast Asia also represents a large symbolic and regional audience that can play both a functional and legitimating role in China's pursuit of Belt and Road. Thus, for strategic, economic, developmental, diplomatic, and diplomatic reasons, it seems logical that Southeast Asia should occupy a prominent place in China's Belt and Road. And in fact, Southeast Asian states were identified early on as potential partners and participants. China also subsequently announced a supplementary China-ASEAN cooperation fund to also supplement its Silk Road Fund as a way to support Southeast Asian participation. We might further note that Belt and Road serves a number of complementary interests. In particular, Belt and Road plus the AIIB serves important domestic and regime interests on both sides. For both China and Southeast Asian states, for example, Belt and Road offers opportunities to develop less developed areas and that have challenged larger priorities and interests. For China, such areas include some of its border provinces, its border localities, some of which are among its less economically developed, and in some cases among its more politically challenged. For ASEAN states, Belt and Road similarly can serve to channel funding and investment to not just national development priorities of specific states, but also ASEAN's less developed subregions and less developed states that can challenge ASEAN's own cooperative agendas. On the specific question of infrastructure, we might also draw particular attention to just how much of Asia's infrastructure needs go unmet and underfunded. In this sense, Southeast Asian states generally welcome an alternative source of development funding, especially given the tremendous needs in the region, as well as the tremendous shortage of funds offered by existing financial arrangements. Belt and Road and the AIIB also responds to some shared interests. In particular, it responds to a larger economic vulnerability shared by both China and the Southeast Asian states. Namely, their particular reliance on external markets to drive growth, a fact that has been a persistent and chronic source of vulnerability, as well as a concern across the region, especially since the late 1980s. The most recent 2008 global financial crisis has also underscored those concerns. For China, the global slowdown exacerbates an already existing problem of excess labor and excess industrial capacity. For Southeast Asia, which have also been among the world's most trade-dependent economies, the global slowdown similarly offers incentives to develop alternative drivers of growth. In this vein, Belt and Road plus the AIIB may be seen as state-led or state-facilitated approaches to creating additional regional demand that can offset the economic and political consequences of reduced global demand. As regards the particular question of regional integration, Belt and Road is made especially interesting as a policy of regionalization. Specifically, Belt and Road initiatives regionalize policies that had previously been strictly bilateral. That is, Belt and Road bring under a common regional and pan-regional developmental framework a range of initiatives that had previously been pursued within the contours and structures and demands of specific individual bilateral relationships. In this sense, and by one view, Belt and Road offers new packaging on pre-existing initiatives and priorities. Still, the packaging matters. Moreover, the packaging is also more than cosmetic, because it shifts and expands the potential significance and implications of China's initiatives regionally and even globally. As a state-led regionalizing approach, or state-facilitated regionalizing approach, that draws on the tools of infrastructure development to create regional connectivity in response to shared, overlapping, and complementary economic and developmental vulnerabilities, And it's worth noting here that much of Asia's and ASEAN's existing post-Cold War regional frameworks and regionalisms have in fact been about offsetting the vulnerabilities associated with global markets, global institutions, and global partners. In addition, as an exercise in regional economic cooperation, Belt and Road might also be viewed as part of China's own regional progression. Whereas previously, China's engagement with regionalism was billed as first reluctant, then pro forma, it thus seems significant that China's recent initiatives should assume regional forms and expressions. Partly, this may reflect the process of adaptation to institutional and regional trends that have been associated with ASEAN, that is, the system of overlapping, sometimes competing, sometimes complementary regional frameworks and arrangements has contributed to the expectation peculiar to post-Cold War East and Southeast Asia, which is the expectation that states seeking recognition for initiative should adopt the form, even if not always the substance, of what constitutes, quote, a regional initiative in Southeast Asia. In this vein, China's also appealed to ASEAN's Master Connectivity Plan. And as mentioned, it has promised to direct additional money specifically to China-ASEAN infrastructure development as a way to supplement, again, the Silk Road. So in these different respects, then, China's initiatives offer much that is familiar and recognizable and also attractive, much that also echoes the developmental and regime priorities of Southeast Asian states. In addition, the emphasis that China has placed on transportation networks and infrastructure development, trade and investment facilitation zones, and targeted development projects, by one argument, supports ASEAN's identified regional integration agendas more directly than, for example, traditional aid donors and investors typically from Western OECD countries. China's approach also stands in contrast with the United States, which has pursued connectivity as well, but connectivity instead through standardized economic rules and market liberalization. At the same time, as I've also suggested, while much may be familiar and recognizable, Belt and Road as a policy of regional engagement also suggests regionalism of a different type than what has been practiced. For one, as mentioned, one reason that these initiatives have drawn so much attention is because Belt and Road suggests a confidence and a degree of proactive Chinese initiative that has been unprecedented. To be sure, Belt and Road initiatives are not the only instances of proactive institutional and economic initiative on China's part. We've seen Beijing, for example, taking larger, more substantive roles in other frameworks. And we've also seen Beijing increasingly seeking out more formally recognized positions of regional leadership. Nevertheless, Belt and Road as well as the AIIB stand out. They stand out again for China's proactiveness in initiating them. They also stand out for China's interest in moving beyond existing frameworks. And in particular, moving beyond existing ASEAN frameworks, which represent the institutional status quo. All these initiatives represent China's new willingness to promote and support alternative China-led frameworks. Put another way, as initiatives proposed, pushed, and peddled by Beijing, Belt and Road stands out for marking China's transition from being a mere participant in regional processes to being one that is offering its own proposals and that potentially redirect and reorganize regional processes, economic integration, and diplomatic attention in new, more China-centric patterns. This point is underscored by some other dynamics, reflective of the distinctly different integrative rationales that have defined China's Belt and Road. First, notwithstanding the shared emphasis that both China and ASEAN states have placed on common development as an important rationale for regionalization, this is a conceptualization of common development that nevertheless projects very different organizing principles on which to base regional cooperation. That is, Belt and Road shifts the developmental and security imperative away from the diplomatic strategic concerns that that ASEAN's own pursuit, that has defined ASEAN's own pursuit of regional cooperation and security, and instead towards the more narrowly self-interested imperative of associating with China as a major benefactor and driver of regional development and integration. Second, China's regional engagement is also offset by the considerable bilateralism that has typified China's pursuit of Belt and Road thus far. There are pluses and minuses to this, of course. The pluses are that it suggests a certain flexibility, an ability to adapt to differences on the ground, to different state situations and conditions, for example. On the other hand, it is also it also underscores an important structural dynamic. Right? It underscores an important structural dynamic of China-Southeast Asia relations. And in particular, this bilateralism in practice, which again suggests the negotiations between a larger China and smaller Southeast Asian states, is also what makes Belt and Road more politically problematic than, or challenging for Southeast Asian states than, for example, the AIIB, which though China led, is also still multilateral. It's also worth noting that in terms of the various funding sources that support China's Belt and Road Initiative, that the majority of them, with the exception of the AIIB and maybe the China-ASEAN Investment Cooperation Fund, that these are China-backed, China-sourced investment funds. The bilateralism of Belt and Road means that while China may be accommodating local needs, win-win, the ensuing relationship created by such bilateral and sub-regional negotiations is nevertheless one that structurally privileges China, the actor able to bestow, deny, and bypass states altogether. In this sense, while Belt and Road may be seen as an instance of regionalization in its promotion of regional integration through regional connectivity, its bilateralism also means that it is not necessarily regionalism in the sense of regional multilateralism. This leads to a third point, which is that rather than one single coherent set of uniform policies, as Belt and Road is so often projected to be, what we find instead is a multi-component framework that connects diverse parts piece by piece. Or put another way, in Belt and Road we find not one road, not one belt, but instead many belts and many roads. Certainly we see this in Southeast Asia. We see this in the varied, multi-scaled, tailored-to-place initiatives in Southeast Asia, a dynamic that also plays to the many interests that, of course, also constitute Southeast Asia, as well as ASEAN as an institution. Finally, fourth, there are also implications, then, for ASEAN's larger integration agendas. Precisely because Belt and Road shifts the integrative logic to the benefits of associating with China, this affects the overall patterns of regional integration. For example, it can pull the diverse interests of ASEAN states in different directions, and thus shift the direction and orientation of their development efforts, resulting in stronger centrifugal incentives and pressures. Let me make a few additional points about the potential strategic implications. To say that regional conceptualizations projected by Belt and Road potentially challenge ASEAN is not to say that there are not benefits to association. Rather, in contrasting these different integrative logics, my point is simply to say that it is the substantive differences over integrative drivers, rationales, and security imperatives, again, why and how states come together, that have critical bearing on some very practical and political questions confronting the region and, again, ASEAN's place in it. Again, it has bearing on questions about how a region should be organized, who gets to participate, what and who is projected, what its institutions look like, and which actors get to play the leading roles. My second point, Belt and Road remains in some critical ways more concept than reality. There are plenty of questions about implementation and China's ability to carry it off, for example. In fact, China faces challenges of implementation at both the China ends and recipient ends of the equation. Achieving Belt and Road depends on the kinds of resources China's willing to commit, especially in the face of many other competing domestic demands and needs, and as well as its ability to coordinate and discipline its domestic agents. And it's worth noting, just in terms of, for example, the provision of foreign aid alone, there are at minimum 40 different agencies and units that participate in that process in China. And that's not to say nothing about the private actors that are also involved. Domestically, there are also questions in China among private and official actors about the costs associated with Belt and Road. So some have speculated, for example, that China's pursuit of the multilateral AIIB is part of the realization that it cannot fund these projects all by itself. Perhaps most of all, Belt and Road has been contingent on how sensitive, and it will remain contingent on, how sensitive China is, not just to the local needs of Southeast Asian states, but also local sensitivities of Southeast Asian states. In Southeast Asia, we already see complications in implementation, and in some cases, pushback from individual states as well as from ASEAN, and notably from different categories of ASEAN states. So for example, among ASEAN's most activist South China Sea claimant states, we can point to the politicization of Chinese projects and investments in the Philippines and Vietnam. In ASEAN's frontier zone, we can point to Myanmar and the problems associated with projects there as well. In ASEAN's frontier in Indonesia, the failure of Chinese agents to conform and adapt to local regulatory expectations and contexts. And even in states typically considered among China's more stable partnerships, we see tensions in Thailand, for example, over railways and questions about land use. So while these different states have also in general continued to work with China and to make sure that they are not bypassed by Belt and Road, these complications also serve as a reminder that as much as economics may mitigate geostrategic calculuses, the opposite is also true, that the political and geostrategic can also affect the attractiveness of economic initiatives. For ASEAN, there are at least two categories of challenges going forward. One is geopolitical. And again, for many Southeast Asian states, it may be difficult not to lose sight of the fact that China's ambitious economic initiatives also coincide again with expansive activities in other areas, including the maritime realm. At a minimum, China's rising power status means China simply has more leverage. A fact again underscored by the structure of Belt and Road negotiations and its implementation. And there are broadly shared, and even if to varying degrees, concerns about how China will use its position. In an ideal world, questions about intent should not outweigh, quote, estimations of what can be accomplished. But such questions may in fact prove the most complex challenge faced by China going forward, and on a range of issues and priorities, not just Belt and Road. The challenge of Southeast Asian states is how to convince China, as well as other regional powers and major actors, that in the end, it's in their interest to support a more integrated Southeast Asia as such. The second related set of challenges for ASEAN is political and intra-ASEAN. Put another way, this is about ASEAN's capacity to work together. Reconciling individual ASEAN positions has long been part of the institutional character of ASEAN. Partly this is due to the diversity of material interests, political positions, policy preferences of ASEAN states. But partly also it's due to the institutional culture of ASEAN, in which individual states, less the collective, tend to have pride of place. All this being said, China's approach to both AIIB and Belt and Road have also been adaptive And this may be a point that is perhaps too often underappreciated, that Belt and Road is, in fact, a work in progress. While the fundamental imperatives and incentives driving China's initiatives seem less likely to change, there's nevertheless room to negotiate how they are pursued, the terms of China's engagement, and the effects that they have. The question, then, is how can these initiatives be made to serve us in shared geopolitical concerns vis-a-vis a variety of larger actors in Asia, collective ASEAN's own particular regional integration agendas, and ASEAN's particular institutional concerns as a Southeast Asian organization. As a large symbolic audience for major powers in the region, there are some things that ASEAN can do and certainly prioritize. One, ASEAN can redirect proposals to better serve ASEAN's integrative developmental, political interests and priorities, as opposed to simply the needs of individual states in ASEAN. With Belt and Road, the most obvious opportunity may be to direct investments and priorities as laid out and identified by ASEAN's master plan on ASEAN connectivity. And again, ASEAN has already begun to do this. Making ASEAN's impact more of a priority and a focus in Belt and Road negotiations can do at least two related things. One, it can better link Belt and Road to the larger project of unifying and strengthening the connections between ASEAN states, as opposed to, again, national development via individual ASEAN states' connection to China. The challenge may be most pressing in continental Southeast Asia. Though, again, China, it's worth noting and underscoring that China is certainly not unrivaled in continental Southeast Asia in terms of investment, trade, and other and economic areas. Still, it's in continental Southeast Asia where we find Southeast Asian states that border China, some of ASEAN's least developed economies, and also ASEAN's newest members. The combination of these three factors, geographic, economic, and institutional, has meant that in continental Southeast Asia, we also find some of Southeast Asia's more comprehensive domestic, economic, demographic, and strategic intersections and interdependencies with China. For these states also, it might be additionally observed that there is much about Belt and Road that is familiar. Belt and Road also assumes projects that were already in play before the launch of Belt and Road. For these reasons, and as noted, these states also present then challenges to ASEAN's own integration agendas and also ASEAN's collective public face. Thus, as regards these states especially, focusing on national development of specific and individual states only goes so far in offsetting larger political questions for ASEAN vis-a-vis, again, a variety of major actors. For these states, China will always be important for good and for bad. The question is how to make ASEAN and the ASEAN economy also just as important. Two, a second set of states we might also mention is in maritime Southeast Asia. In maritime Southeast Asia as well, there are concerns and opportunities. The most critical state here may be Indonesia, which by itself actually represents the connection and the links between the Indian Pacific Oceans. For Indonesia, the AIIB and the AIIB-associated Maritime Silk Road Initiative at Belt and Road in general offer the promise of additional resources that can serve, for example, Indonesia's and President Jokowi's particular interest in developing West-East connectivity and a larger national integration agenda. For reasons of size, history, and geography, the question then becomes how to ensure Indonesia's continued interest in prioritization of ASEAN and its projects in the face of national priorities and in the face of domestic change. Another concern is the Philippines, which may be more in danger of being bypassed. And here I might say the danger of being bypassed has less to do with the South China Sea. But rather because if we look at the maps of Belt and Road and articulations of Belt and Road is projected in the opposite direction. It's projected west. And so if you look, sorry, this is a little bit out of order. So if you look, for example, at maps such as this one, the Philippines is bypassed. Now, this being said, just as China has also made explicit that the Philippines will not be bypassed, and in other maps, we do see the Philippines being linked, for example, being through an extension of the Continental Silk Road. So in any case, there are a number of different areas that ASEAN can also focus on in terms of ensuring that its own integration agenda is also prioritized and linked and supported by Belt and Road. Focusing on MPAC can also help offset what some worry to be the potential then for Belt and Road to fragment ASEAN Southeast Asia along mainland and maritime lines. In this vein, ASEAN has already begun to push the MPAC agenda in China and ASEAN's 10 plus 1 meetings, for example. Again, there's a lot of common ground between China's Belt and Road and ASEAN's MPAC when it comes to development and security via infrastructure and economic development. But common ground does not mean that the geopolitical outcome will be the same. Two, a second priority for ASEAN might be to be more concerted itself about how extra-regional interests via MPAC might also offset geopolitical and centrifugal pressures. For example, we've already seen MPAC providing a focal point for states like Japan that are also interested in pushing back against China's initiatives through its own infrastructure initiatives and projects. But while its competitive attention might serve specific projects or specific states, such competitive and varied efforts, much like the varied roads of Belt and Road, can also be fragmenting in the divergent interests and priorities at play, fragmenting in the patterns of connectivity produced. And in this sense, MPAC may offer ASEAN states the opportunity to be more concerted then about directing extra-regional attention to common and collaborative projects, not just with ASEAN, but also to China's Belt and Road. This would help mitigate then, thinking about again these different major powers' engagements with ASEAN, this would help mitigate some of the centrifugal tendencies created by extra-regional competition and competing projects. It would also help mitigate some of the structural dynamic associated with China's bilateral pursuit or negotiations in pursuit of Belt and Road. Such interest in joint and collaborative projects would also be supported by the AIIB's current interest in partnering with other MDBs on jointly funded projects. Both these points, that is making MPAC more of a focus in ASEAN and ASEAN states' Belt and Road relationship with China, and also making MPAC much more of a common and joint project among extra-regional partners, also offers opportunities in that most MPAC projects involve also more than one ASEAN actor. It is also an opportunity then to harmonize the development projects of different ASEAN states and their cross-border bureaucracies that don't always work so well together. In short, through MPAC, there are opportunities to direct China's and other states' engagement in ways that can offset some important concerns. MPAC can't solve or eradicate the structural or geopolitical dilemma that all states face as neighbors proximate to a much larger China. But a more strategic consideration of MPAC can mitigate some of those structural concerns and again moderate some of the effects they have, as well as help rationalize ASEAN's own divergent interests. By way of conclusion, let me say that few initiatives capture as many aspects of China's growing influence in Southeast Asia as do China's Belt and Road initiatives. The initiatives that constitute China's Belt and Road touch on practically every respect of China's relations with Southeast Asia. They are economic and developmental, they are political and geopolitical, they are regional and global, but also local and domestic. They also have institutional dimensions that have implications for ASEAN as a Southeast Asian organization and its own place in East Asia's regional transition. China's Belt and Road marks an important moment of regional transition. While we can debate matters of implementation, effect, and efficacy, it does suggest a shift in the projected role that China has to play in the construction of regional order. and a projected reordering or effort a projected reordering and reorganization of regions around different functions and different actors that could have political and practical implications for the for ASEAN and Southeast Asia, and potentially for the practice of regionalism as they have known it. Thank you.